We are here. Sarah Van Gelder has generously agreed to stay with us. She was here in the first part of our program. She's co-founder and executive editor of Yes Magazine and yesmagazine.org, and which spends a lot of time in their magazine looking at what people are struggling on the ground across America. And it's not just a view from the top, but their magazine really is a view from the under that takes place in Baltimore, that takes place in Iowa, Chicago, Oregon, New York, and everywhere. She's staying with us for this conversation. We're also joined in the studio. The Reverend Meredith Moyes is with us. Meredith Moyes is an ordained minister, writer, community activist, and teacher. She is one of the first black women ordained in the old Catholic movement here in Baltimore. She's certainly currently a climate organizer in a local organization working in the environmental movement. We are also joined by Jeff Singer, who is founder and former executive director of Healthcare for the Homeless and now an instructor at the University of Maryland School of Social Work. And Sergio España, who is statewide organizer for Healthcare as a Human Right Maryland. And good to have you all with us.
Good morning, Mark.
Thank you.
And the number here is 410-319-8888. You can write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages. And you can also tweet us at Mark Steiner. But call 410-319-8888. I want to hear what you think are the issues that can really grab people in this year of 2014, especially in this listening audience from Maryland, Washington, Virginia, and around, and what you think can be the kind of push, what has to happen in the state legislature. This weekend, I was commenting on the inauguration of Mayor de Blasio in New York. One of the things that that people were talking about was the fact that he's looking for a pre-K, universal pre-K, and my thought about that is that in almost every state where there's a liberal progressive governor or running for office, everybody's talking about pre-K. It's going to happen at some level. But the other thing he said that people are not paying attention to is something that's a debate here and in many cities around America is when he said developers in New York City are going to have to pay for affordable housing for New Yorkers, that part of the money they get, part of what they're spending has to go to affordable housing, something that is battling here on the ground here in Baltimore and across America, which is kind of one of the keys to battling poverty is people having homes to live in. We remember there was no homelessness in America before the 1980s, hardly any at all. All of a sudden, they took all the money away and people started losing their homes, and it just got worse. And so that's what we're facing. We think about that in this very cold day coming up throughout most of America where the homeless are going. So I'm curious what we think. Sarah, let me start off with you, and then we'll get into our studio here. And issues like that. I mean, these are the things to me that kind of involves the grassroots. It involves the reality of what's happening in communities on streets and plains around America, because it is about economic equality. It's about changing the paradigm, and I think many people in America want to see that. Sarah. We have Sarah?
Oh, I'm sorry. Were you speaking to me?
Yeah, I was.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you said in the studio. Yeah, I think inequality is absolutely central to what we're up against right now in so many different areas, whether it's political power and the power of the 1% to adjust what happens in terms of what policies can happen, whether it's housing, whether it's education. You know, so much of it comes back to this enormous inequality we have in the United States right now. And in terms of housing policy, if you take as a given that there's huge inequality, it makes it really tough to find a way to make the housing thing work. But, you know, I think the Mayor de Blasio's scheme sounds like a really good starting place to make sure that new development includes housing that's affordable. One of the models that we really love out of Boston is the Dudley Street Initiative, where people have been, you know, actually the community is actually taking control of a chunk of really key land, and they're making sure that the housing that's built there is affordable, that there's opportunity for small businesses to get started, but the community ultimately has this decision making over that chunk of land, and it's been extraordinarily successful.
And that's about pushing this stuff on the ground here, Jeff Singer.
Indeed, we have a good deal of work to do, and there's been some preliminary organizing to do that work. As you all know, Baltimore does have an inclusionary zoning law, and supposedly big projects that get public subsidies should include affordable housing. However, the law is fundamentally flawed, needs to be rewritten, because currently it requires the city to actually pay the developers to build the affordable housing, and the city has no money. Now, on the other hand, the city does have
money. It's really
not
funny if you think about it for more than a second.
Yeah. Now, the city does have money to contribute to large developers to build housing that isn't affordable. They just gave somewhere between $300 and $500 million to build on Harbor Point. But the city doesn't have money for affordable housing. And I must add here that we do have some programs and some money that's come into the city recently for housing, but it's not being used for affordable housing. It's being used to tear down
What do you mean?
Housing. We have a mortgage settlement, for example, that came into the city in August, about $22 million from a national mortgage settlement. But the city's announced they're using that money to tear down vacant houses so that developers can build more unaffordable housing. And we think that's a seriously flawed policy.
So how do you think the four of you here and out there, 410-319-8888, and Clarence, we're going to come to your call in just a second. And we want to hear your thoughts. We were waiting on for the last hour. We're going to make sure you get on here as soon as we have this comment. So how does that happen? I'm curious how you think a community gets organized to really address an issue like this. I mean, the majority of people in Baltimore, whether the housing is good or stinks, has a place to live. For the most part, we have a huge amount of poverty here. So people are in and out of houses, and out of homelessness in the city. So how do you begin to organize around that in this kind of community? And I want to hear it after you all comment. I'd like to hear what Sarah thinks about how people do it around the country and how this organizing takes place. Meredith?
Well, part of the issue is we have to assess what's really going on the ground, and having worked with young people between the ages of 16 and 24, unfortunately, a lot of the youth know that there's something amiss, but they don't know what it is. And then a lot of this has to do with, this is the way things always have always been, so why change it, or how can I change it? So allowing people to understand that they are empowered is one thing, and meeting people where they are, and also to realizing that people are purposely ignorant of their issues.
What do you mean purposely ignorant?
I mean, like, I had students who were when I taught special ed, they were emotionally disturbed. That was the baseline. But many of them didn't have.
We're all emotionally disturbed,
right? How about that? We live in America. A lot of them didn't have cognitive impairment. So when we're going over the lesson, I used to teach geography, and I'm teaching the map, and they couldn't tell me what the capital of Maryland was. But you know all of Lil Wayne and Gucci Mane songs. We're gonna have a dialogue. You see what I'm saying? So, and then I look at the history of how information got passed along to people, and those traditional vectors, like black radio, right, really aren't activist-like anymore. So if people aren't talking about it in these venues where folks are, then they are literally oblivious to that. So a lot of the stuff that we have to do on the ground is meet people where they are. If that means that we have to go into the bar on Saturday night and just kick it with a couple of folks and sit around with three or four folks, and this is what we're doing, and people are like, wow, what are these people doing? And we seem excited, and stuff grows like that, then that's what we have to do. If that means that the usual church crowd that's not engaged, we have to go to a mass, we have to go to a service on a Sunday morning or even a Saturday night and meet people where they are, we absolutely have to do that. You know, we can't expect people to know off the top what exactly is going on.
So, Sergio, as an organizer, I mean, your thoughts on this. I remember years ago when organizing tenants unions, we did organize in bars, we did organize in barbershops, we did organize in the corner, and went door to door. That's what you do.
That's what we do. I mean, not so much the bar stuff, per se.
You're missing a whole level here, man.
But, you know, like, yeah, within the work that we do within the healthcare campaign and within United Workers, where we're based, our main focus is on being out there in the community where it's at and being a part of the community. You know, like, for example, the work that we're doing, being led by high school students in Brooklyn and Curtis Bay around the incinerator, which might be the largest incinerator in the country. They're trying to build in the most polluted part of the state, which is ridiculous. The way in which that came about was by students, just discussing amongst themselves, you know, like, what are all the things that get them angry, that marginalize them, that dehumanize dehumanize them. And then one of those issues that we, that the students decided was something that could speak more broadly was the incinerator issue. So we with the students started doing canvassing and going door to door and talking with the neighbors and the neighbors realized they didn't even know that this project was happening, and then got extremely furious about it and it's been a galvanizing force. We just had a big march a couple weeks ago around this, and
led by young people,
led by students, and there's with what we do with a the healthcare
and a multiracial group,
exactly, and that's what I was going to get at with with United Workers or with the healthcare campaign is that we're actively focused on leadership development, but also on the need for us to cross these boundaries of color and class. We talk about how the system we have right now is very deliberately keeping us fighting amongst ourselves, what we call plantation politics, where you have like poor whites, poor blacks, and other minorities fighting each other over scraps, so that we lose sight over the Mount Everest of resources that a very small group of folks have that they use just a little portion of those resources to keep us fighting for those scraps, And so once we start creating the spaces where we have folks, we have within our campaigns right now, we started this project called the Human Rights Educator Project process, where we're having folks from rural Maryland, from inner city Baltimore, middle class folks who are all working on issues around housing, around Harbor Point, around the incinerator, around universal health care, and bringing us all together to talk about issues that we all have in common and the need for us to be building grassroots movement. And through that, it gets also at this sense of what Sherrilyn Ifill was talking about earlier about. And the piece about just like what came out of that Baltimore Sun, article, or whatever, was the sense that people don't matter. That as long as like as you're good, other people who are the ones who are dying don't matter. Like, it's horrifying. So what we actively try to do is create spaces where we actually the folks who are homeless, the folks who lost their houses to medical bankruptcy, the folks who are working two jobs but are still poor, and so are seen as being poor and being less than us. Like, let's all be in the same room and let's realize very quickly that not just are they human beings, but oh my gosh, like I have so much to learn from them, and vice versa, and really building that glue. And that's something that we're very active about and something that we're all yearning for. We know how needlessly marginalized we are, and we want to talk to one another, and we stop thinking that the way in which we are is what we hear on the media.
So, Sarah, I'm curious, and kind of from your vantage point, because you do a lot of working locally, see what's happening in the Northwest, but you also look across the country. When you hear this conversation taking place, how does that relate to what you're seeing around America?
Well, I think this is what's happening all over the country, and that's one of the things I'm so encouraged about as we go into the new year, is that there is this kind of organizing. Ordinary people are getting in touch with one another and talking about what they want out of the future. I mentioned in the last hour the National People's Action and their principles of the new economy. These are movements of ordinary people, poor people's movements, working class people's movements, that are coming together to say, what is the economy that we want to create? Not just how do we respond to the latest bad idea that's coming from the right or from the 1%, but what do we as ordinary people want to create? And one of the items on their new agenda is the democratic control of capital and how important it is to have ways in which we can invest through infrastructure banks or state banks. We can invest in the things we want, like community land trusts that can keep land in the public domain or in the commons or in the community and for the public benefit, rather than allow it to be in a speculative market where ordinary people can easily get priced out as soon as wealthy people or developers want the land.
This is part of the idea, and we're going to go to the phones right here. This is part of the idea of as you organize to force change and make change, it's also creating alternative institutions and alternative ways of living on the ground as you're doing that. That's part of this.
So it's a really powerful combination to do both at once, because we both need to be responding when something comes along, when our neighborhoods are getting disrupted or people are getting gentrified out of their neighborhoods. We need to be able to respond, and we need those community organizing on the ground to be able to do that. And we need to be building a better kind of an economy so that we're not only responding, we're actually able to, in the long run, have a good way of life for ordinary people, not just the top 1%.
I'm sorry.
Let me just get the phones here.
Sure.
Okay, very quickly, Meredith.
I was just going to say that in regard to what the commissioner said, I don't know if that was a personal statement from him, but it seems like the behavior of the what's coming out of City Hall kind of you know, basically confirms his statement. So based on what the sister just said, you know, I think that when we build life-affirming institutions in our community where everybody matters, that counteracts what we're hearing from municipal government. Like, these people over here, we mm-hmm. don't really care about them. But if I'm in a neighborhood where everybody cares about each other, mm-hmm. then that will offset the lack of response, the lack of human compassion that we're seeing from municipal government in certain areas.
Let's open the phones here, 410-319-8888. Clarence, you're on the air.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Steiner.
Thanks for calling.
You know, I take my cue from Dr. Noah Crosby on this, whose lecture, how law is used to destroy democracy or limit civil rights and so forth and so forth. And under that title, he had a picture of the Supreme Court. Now, if any of these movements, be it economic equality, housing, locally, nationally, end up as a battle before the Supreme Court or a local court, whose seemingly function is to protect corporate and businesses' rights first and individuals' rights second, then how do you structure your fight against that? I mean, that would be the adversary, the elephant in the room, as by my point of view. Thank you, Mr. Steiner.
Thank you. Now, do you think in some ways that we get so legally bound up in these battles and it becomes part of the legal system and that thwarts things?
As Sherrilyn Ifill said, Mark, using the judicial system for social change is only a small part mm-hmm. of the strategies that we have to use to mobilize. So a social movement can overcome a bad court system and always has.
Always has.
Always has. Always will. The power lies with the people, Mark.
Yeah, the catch is how to get us to actually, you know, build those movements and build those mass numbers of folks where it isn't just a, you know, like where right now, I mean, where the majority of the American people, we're pretty much on the same page in terms of economic inequality, in terms of in many aspects of discrimination, you know, but we don't get the sense of how we're actively working together, you know. So you know, part of, I think, the Paula Deen and Duck Dynasty crap that y'all were talking about earlier, part of the reason why I think it's popular is also, or it's discussed, isn't just because it's like the big evil media, like being like, talk about this. This is the only way to talk about race. But it's also because, you know, a lot of us on Facebook and stuff just feel like, oh, this is a freebie. This is an easy way of saying that we agree with each other. And we just kind of leave it at that. You know, so what we really need to be doing is, and what we are doing is, and just we need to just make that a clearer focus more broadly, is to make just, next time that happens, just forget about that. Don't worry about that. Just instead, just thinking like, what's going on within your communities? What are your friends up to? What is your family up to? What's going on in your church? How can you push your faith institutions and whatnot? And realize that it's not an issue, you know, Sherrilyn Ifill talked about this too, but like, you know, there's not going to be like one awesome, you know, conference where everything gets solved, you know, like you know, or you know, none of us here on the panel have the answers as well. You know, like the only way that it works, the only way we've been able to have the victories that we've had here in Baltimore is by giving power and leadership to a wide range of folks throughout the city, you know, and now we're starting to do that around the state. And the way in which that happens is by the folks who are listening to this station right now, recognizing that they're the agents of change as well, you know, and recognizing that means that you got to step just a little bit out of your comfort zone sometimes, or sometimes realize that you're already doing the work. You just feel that you're not.
Well, I'm sorry. I mean to cut you off, Sergio.
I was going to say that one of the very interesting things about the whole Duck Dynasty dust-up, which I thought was really stupid and crazy, and that's kind of what I expect Bird Killer Phil to think. Like, I wasn't surprised or shocked. Right. Was that you had quasi-corporate nonprofits fundraising off of that. Actually sending out emails, you know, fight this and give us $5 or whatever. So going back to the local level, if I see these so-called nonprofits that are supposed to represent my community doing stuff that really is antithetical to what I'm doing here locally, then these are the people I don't need to give my money to. And I think that we need to understand the dynamics at play and support our own, as everyone on the panel is saying. I get really tired of folks coming in saying, well, this is what we're doing and this is what we're leading, and then they're pulling up states, leaving, and the rest of us are here after people have donated oodles of money to this cause or that cause. They've left, and we're here, and we still have nothing. It is time to really consolidate our resources for ourselves so that we can move forward collectively.
Let me open the phones here, 410-319-8888. Then I want to talk a little about health care and the battle around health care and what's taking place there, and look at Pope Francis and talk about this new economy in the making. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Bruce, you're on the air.
Yeah, so I'm listening to this, and believe me, I'm a lot more open-minded than some of you people might think. So you're talking ordinary people. You know, maybe some of us conservatives are ordinary people, too. You talk about diversity. What Phil Robertson said on Duck Dynasty, I didn't exactly hear what he has to say, but he has the right to say what he has to say, and he shouldn't be considered a racist or a bigot or homophobic just because you don't agree with him. And as far as while we're at it, the person from the NAACP, the same yada, yada, yada all the time. So here's the thing. So I agree. Maybe there should be an increase in the minimum wage. So what happens is, instead of being pragmatic, Mark, instead of the NAACP being realistic, and some of the people that are supposedly in the interest of poverty and poor people, you have to understand you just can't raise the minimum wage from $7.25 an hour to $15 an hour, because what you have to understand, if you've ever met a payroll, I haven't, but anybody that's ever run a business, particularly small businesses, what business is really all about is small businesses. There are a lot more small businesses out there, and what happens is the businesses that are smaller, that work on smaller profits or margin, you're going to destroy them. You're going to drive them into the ground, or somebody that has a little machine shop or landscape business or whatever it is, he or she won't be able to expand because they're going to double it. 75 cents an hour for 3 years. You're not pragmatic. It's biased. It's particularly biased, and you use this, it's always racist, it's always homophobic, that conservatives don't care, we don't have any empathy. I don't walk lockstep with all the conservatives, but, you know, I just get tired of the same old dogma from you people.
Okay,
every
Bruce,
day.
Thanks, Bruce. And I think that, let me just, I appreciate the call, and I would say, first of all, we're not going to get stuck on Duck Dynasty, but the guy's name is Robertson. I didn't even know who they were until this whole thing came
up.
What I read, what he wrote, what he said, I mean, his own words showed that he was both homophobic and a racist. But what he said, I didn't even know the guy. And the last thing I would ever say is I never would equate being conservative or any political ideology mm-hmm. with being racist or being homophobic. I think that is a game that people play that divides people that I don't play and don't want to play. But I think what we will wrestle with as soon as we come back from this break, and I'll let Sarah Van Gelder lead off and all of us jump in, is this minimum wage. And what if you did, because our political argument is let's ease it in $9 an hour, $10 an hour to 15, or do you do it overnight at 15? And what does it mean to raise the minimum wage? How does it affect the economy and business? How does it affect people's lives? Because it's going to be in the state legislature here, and we'll be talking about that Wednesday with them at Annapolis Summit. So let's wrestle with that when we come back. 410-319-8888. We'll be right back with our guests looking at the future. In Tunisia. He passed away on this day in 1993, and honor him and his memory and his great music during our breaks. We are here at this hour with Sarah Van Gelder, co-founder and executive editor of Yes Magazine and YesMagazine.org. Jeff Singer, who is founder and former executive director of Healthcare for the Homeless, and now an instructor at the University of Maryland School of Social Work. Sergio Espana, who is statewide organizer for Healthcare's Human Right Maryland. The Reverend Meredith Moy is ordained minister, writer, community activist, and teacher, and one of the first black women ordained in the Old Catholic Movement in Baltimore, and currently works in the environmental movement in our community. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. Log on to our Facebook page, which I'll look at. Before we go back to the phones, then, Key, you are our next caller up. We're going to come to your call. I do want to get the environmental movement that Sarah covers really in depth and what's happening around the country and what Meredith sees in Baltimore and how that works out with the battles that Sergio sees as well. But let's talk about this minimum wage thing for a moment. I think that the Bruce, our last caller, talking about the minimum wage as something that would destroy the economy if it was raised immediately to $15 an hour. Let me start with Sarah, and then we'll run over to Jeff. Sarah?
Yes. Well, actually, in SeaTac, Washington, the $15 minimum wage that was just enacted by the voters exempts any employers who have less than 30 employees. So to start off with, in terms of his complaint that will put a lot of small businesses out of business, that was really specifically taken into account. I think the thing about the minimum wage is that if you're looking at what can get the economy going in a sustainable, long-term way, you need to put money in people's pockets. They tried the Fed top-down version from the Federal Reserve of pouring money, free money, into the coffers of the banks with the hope that they would lend money to businesses and those businesses would get the economy going. Well, businesses aren't going to invest unless people have the money to spend to buy their stuff. And as long as wages are so low, that's keeping a huge damper on the economy. So the very best way we can actually get the economy going again is to put money in people's pockets that they can spend into the economy and especially into their local economy. And that, you know, that's where our economic vitality can come from. So I think that, you know, on all counts, a minimum wage is a really good idea. And some people even look at the possibility of a guaranteed minimum income across the board so that everyone has money to spend, no matter what their condition is, whether they're disabled, whether they're unemployed, you know, whatever their condition is, that there's a guaranteed minimum income. And, you know, again, if you're looking at keeping an economy functioning and thriving and dealing with a lot of the hazards that go along with poverty, that's a really good way to go.
Hear, hear. Richard Nixon, you know, endorsed the notion of having a guaranteed minimum income about 50 years ago. Not that we're Nixon fans necessarily, but the people of Switzerland are organizing now to have a guaranteed annual income of about $32,000 a year. And just as the best plan for reforming healthcare is to divorce healthcare from employment and just make sure everybody gets it, the best plan for income would be to divorce income from employment and make sure everyone has what they need.
That would be a huge – I mean, that would be a battle that's going to take a while in this country. I mean, even getting beyond the minimum wage. But I think that the importance is having those discussions begin and organizing on those things is what gets those things on the table. And I think that can happen. And you see it moving.
Yeah. And just as someone who's – I'm actually a small business owner myself. I started a restaurant with my dad and my brother. And, you know, we started this 3 years ago, and we knew we had to pay folks more than minimum wage because that's – I mean, how are they going to survive? You know, and we've been doing all right, you know, like, you know, so, I mean, we're about to start our fourth year. So the thought that somehow small businesses in general can't pull this off as well is, you know, it's hard running a business, you know, like, but that being said, it's totally possible, you know, and it's also something that, like, you know, our employees are grateful to work there. We have, you know, we have very, very strong retention there. And, you know, a very strong sense of, like, this is ours. All of us shape this, you know, because we treat each other like human beings, you know, so it's not just an issue of, like, it's not just me because, like, I'm like this, like, huge lefty liberal or whatever that I'm doing these issues, you know, or taking this stuff on. You know, we were talking about this over the break. Like, we have to stop with this, you know, this spectrum of, like, liberals and conservatives on these issues when the vast majority of us are under the same boot and dealing with the same amount of, like, mountain of debt. You know, so we just need to move past that and realize that we actually do have a lot more in common, and including on, in the business angle as well.
So let me move back to the phone show real fast. We have a lot of people calling in at 410-319-8888, and we'll try to get you as you called in here, Daki, Diane, Judith, LaVon. 410-319-8888. Daki, you're on the air.
Happy New Year, brother.
Happy New Year, Daki Napata. How are you?
Yeah, I'm pretty good. I've been listening a lot in the last year, haven't been calling in, making analysis, and thanks. So thank you for taking my call. The concern I have, and let me be on the public record also, not only did I support you coming to Morgan, I support you staying at Morgan and VA, and would fight anybody who would try to take you off. My concern is balance. My concern is balance. But that's all I want to say about that issue. And thank you for the invitation in relation to the Reverend Vernon Dobson. In brief, I just think this. I think that when we talk about the attack on human rights, civil rights, and the like, I think we have to be clear and allow people to have their own voice. I was part of the Theology of Liberation conferences of Cornell and like Cornell West, a whole range of people from South America, you know, liberation theologians there, and the people and liberation groups, Native Americans, women groups, all kinds of persons were part of this. How do you make theology relevant, you know, to the conditions of their people, you know? And I remember, and I just want to put this point out there, there was a Native American brother who came, and we were talking about building coalitions and alliances, and he stood up and he said, well, let me say this, and this is our voice. We don't want to integrate with y'all. You know, there's a segment of us that don't want to integrate with y'all, right? You know, and we have a right to have that voice and that opinion, and everybody shouldn't be pushing us, talking about it's a new world, you know, to have to deal with y'all. You know, now everybody doesn't have that viewpoint, but he had the legitimate voice. And so what I'm saying is that as we deal with human rights, you know, whether it be rights for women, whether it be rights for children or cities or whatever the issues, environmental rights, South Africa, you name it, you know, that we have to be able to stand up for equity in the representation of the voice. So when we talk about coalitions and alliances, we always started with principled cooperation or unity. Principled cooperation or unity. That means we come together, we have desires, objectives of what we're going to organize around, and we say we ain't going no place else, you know? And if anybody violates that commitment to principled cooperation or unity, then we're out. And so what I'm saying is, and thank you, and I'll finish here, that if we examine what the brothers and sisters of all persuasions that came together in coalitions in the civil rights movement, and even Minister Malcolm when he moved it up, elevated it to the human rights movement, and in the South Africa movement, you know, I spent 25 years working on the anti-apartheid movement.
Yes, you did.
It is so important, you know, that we have principles of unity. And so, and then principle of unity means that when that person or that organization violates that principle of unity, after having come together to commit to, say, we're going to work on a fair wage, a living wage, you know, okay, then we're not going to work on that, and all of a sudden, the coalition and the alliance that came together all of a sudden now becomes an organization and is working on something else. The Occupy movement was excellent in its inception, you know, and it needed alliances with all kinds of persons. You know, but it's going to dissipate because there were not enough of us coming together and committed to building a movement. One last thing, Mark, and I'm off, and thank you so much for your guests and the work that y'all do. The whole notion of the difference between an event and a movement. When we dealt with the South Africa movement, you know, at the point when we went over there to take those petition drives to the South African embassy, just to say that, you know, we demand equity and divestment and like, and the South African ambassador said, if you don't get away from there, we're going to have us locked up. We say, really? And people responded, and everybody wanted to go to the South African embassy to demonstrate. It was a Gestalt moment. And we had that. We had it with Cesar Chavez. We had it with you working with Billy Brothers campaign. We had it when the students, when we started the radio station there, Morgan, it's on now, it's 37 years old. There was a Gestalt. And so what I'm saying is when that happened, we had folks organized around their self-interest. We had babysitters against apartheid. You know, we had barbers. We had everybody came together out of their self-interest and took a day. We had old people, seniors, in senior citizens' homes who couldn't come to the embassy, who had ribbons on. We had people like Damien, you know, very active at St. Gregory who ascended last year. We have lost so many giants this past year, man.
Yes, we have.
Dobson, my mentor and father, you know what I'm saying? And we've lost so many people, and if we were to replace them, we can't replace them by inadequate representation. So thank you, man, so much. Thank you for what y'all do, and anything I can do to be of help, I'm still on the battlefield, Mark.
I know you are, Daki. Thank you. Dakina Pott has been an activist in this community for a long time, Vietnam vet, and a guy who's been out in the forefront for many years. It's good to have his voice in the air for a few minutes here. There's a lot of people who are calling in. Do we have comments we want to make real fast before we hit these phones? 410-319-8888. Diane, you're on the air.
Yes, hi.
Hi,
Thank
Diane.
You for having me on the call, Mark. I know you haven't spoken about health care yet at length, but I wanted to link what I've heard just in the few minutes of your conversation to health care, the concern that people have about raising the minimum wage and the burden it would place on small businesses. And I wanted to point out that in Maryland, a study was done, Healthcare Now of Maryland, where, and the study was completed exactly a year ago, if we had single payer in the state of Maryland, there's an estimate in the study that there would be 70,000 new jobs created. And additionally, if you look at the healthcarenow.org website, if you just want to know why small businesses should be for single payer, so much of their cost would be dramatically reduced by having single payer, you know, whether it's unemployment insurance or health care benefits, would reduce labor costs by 10 to 12%. It seems to me that one of the solutions in making it possible to raise the minimum wage without burdening small businesses so that everybody's a winner is to enact single payer. So thank you for hearing me, and I look forward to hearing everybody's response.
Yeah, let's tackle this one, and I had it in two ways. Let me go back to start with Sarah. And Sarah, you're leading the campaign here. You're one of the folks leading the campaign in Maryland. We look at the Affordable Health Care Act that's taking place. And I think everybody would agree, at least I think everybody in this room might agree, might not agree, that it's covering more people than ever before. Through Medicaid and things, people are going to be covered for insurance. There's nothing really to kind of change the medical system, guarantee that people have access to health care, and there's many things it doesn't do. So I'm curious how we feel that the health care for all, the single-payer battle, fits into this now, post-ACA, which is a fact of life. It's not going anywhere. I mean, I think that it's a reality that most conservatives are going to have to address eventually. So Sarah, talk about what you see around the country, and I want to talk about what the possibilities are right here in the state of Maryland.
Yeah, thank you, Mark. And clearly, single payer is a better policy. It's far less expensive, and one of the reasons it's less expensive is because instead of building in huge executive pay and profits for all the investors and all the bureaucracy it takes to juggle between different health insurance plans, instead of having to pay for that, you have a very simple system like Medicare that's very straightforward, that was implemented, you know, Medicare was implemented years ago using index cards, and in a few months everybody who was eligible was signed up. It's so simple and straightforward that you just save an enormous amount of headache and enormous amount of money, and in a healthcare system that is already stretched thin, that makes a huge difference. So there are so many reasons why a single payer is a better idea. And you know, when you look at Americans say they want choice, but when they really talk about it, what they want choice in is who provides their medical care. They don't necessarily care who's writing the check to pay the bill. So if you look at who's providing your medical care, you know, now a lot of the insurance plans restrict who you can get medical care from. Single payer, as it's practiced in places like Canada, you know, allow you to go to whatever doctor you want and whatever hospital you want for your medical care. So the thing that's exciting, I think, is that the state of Vermont is actually moving ahead with implementing single payer at a statewide level. It's going to be a challenge, I think, for a small state to take such a different course than the national direction. But I think it's a really great example. It'll be really interesting to see if they can, in fact, save the millions of dollars they believe they can save by going this route. And then it could be an example, depending on how well this Affordable Care Act actually operates in practice. You know, it's been a really rocky start. The administration, the Obama administration, keeps saying it's going to get better. We're going to get past this particular hurdle, and it's going to work more smoothly. And maybe that will happen. And maybe, you know, the people who are uninsured now will get the insurance they want. But I think there's still this sense of discontent about how complex it is, and about being required to buy a product from a private insurance company that you know may or may not have your interest at heart.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, I've been around the state for about a year and a half now, and it's pretty clear that they simply don't have the interest. You know, we've been hearing stories of folks who, you know, thought that they had the best insurance, the best types of coverage, and then once they get hit with an illness, their insurance just kind of disappears and they're stuck with the bill. You know, so I mean, we have medical bankruptcies that are going to remain the same under the ACA, and also, yeah, just as Sarah was saying, just that what we're seeing is that there are folks now who are doing the switch, if they're even lucky, like get onto coverage under the ACA. For example, my father's been trying to get on, and I've been, you know, I work on this, you know, on healthcare stuff, and I've been working for weeks trying to get him to sign up, and it hasn't been working. You know, it's been very frustrating because he's actually is in desperate need of medical care. You know, but even if he were to get care, or if that were to go through like that, like the fact that we have a system that isn't based off of treating health as a right, that isn't based off of treating healthcare as something that's just something that we invest in each other, but instead it's treated as a commodity, it's treated as something can we make money off of this? You know, how much is this gonna, you know, like where's the margin line? How much money am I gonna make out of this? Like the incentives that are in place are just really perverse and are still in place under the ACA. You know, like, so yes, technically we can expand coverage, you know, hopefully, you know, we can get the, you know, stuff to work and whatnot, but the coverage that we get is very, very flimsy at best. And what we're seeing under the state exchanges and stuff is that the kind of plans that you qualify for, first off, there are more restricted networks. And then on top of that, you don't really know what it is that you're getting. And, you know, you can't make decisions about, like, you know, because you could see thinking like, well, if I get a plan where it's $200 a month and a $3,000 deductible, I don't think I can afford that, but I guess, you know, I'll take that on. But then what we're seeing is that, like, these different plans who seem to be in the same way, then when you actually look at the criteria for what they cover, it's not the same. So, you know, so like one plan, you know, you have two plans that say like once, you know, this, they'll both have the same deductible and whatnot, but then in terms of the actual coverage, it's vastly different, and you won't know until you're sick. You know, so how can you possibly make a rational decision?
You've been also involved in this battle for single-payer health care and for health care, and as you founded Health Care for the Homeless.
Yeah, for a while. We've been working on that. The Affordable Care Act is really the Health Industry Guaranteed Profitability Act. Mm-hmm. And it's the clumsiest way that you could imagine to actually get health insurance or, more importantly, health care to people. It's cost hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars to implement, will cost hundreds more. Where does the money go? Well, a lot of it goes to the healthcare industry that our taxes are now guaranteeing their profits. That's what the subsidies are. Our taxes guarantee the profits of health providers. That's crazy. Plus, people can't even sign up for it because if we had a single payer, your Social Security card would be your healthcare card, right? You know, Taiwan, the really capitalist country of Taiwan, their healthcare system wasn't working very well. In 1994, they hired American healthcare economists to help them design a single payer system that they put into place in 95, and it works really well. In fact, their administrative costs are down to 2%. 2%. Our administrative costs are 30%. So where do people get better health care? In, you know, the uber-capitalist Taiwan or in the United States?
410-319-8888. Let me do a little switch gears here, and then I'm going to go back and get a Reverend McKenzie on the phone who called in. But let me talk a bit about environmental movements and social change and what we see around America and what we see here. I know the United Workers, the group that Sergio is working with, is working with people on the east side, putting the incinerator in this working class community on the industrial side of town. That you've been working and organizing in the environmental movement, Meredith, and people don't usually associate African American voices with that movement, but that's a mistake, I think. And Sarah's been watching this across the country with coalitions of whites and Indians across America coming together to battle the pipeline. So how do we see this fitting into this kind of next years of the movement, the struggle for change and bringing people together?
A very dear colleague of mine, I'm going to give Larissa Johnson a shout out, said that the environment is really the hub and the foundation of everything. Because what we're seeing when we talk about healthcare, a lot of what we're seeing in terms of illnesses are coming from the environment. When we're talking about poverty, we notice, as in Curtis Bay, the people with the least are saddled with the most in terms of pollution and things of that nature. What the environmental movement needs to get over is this thought of rich white guys that like to backpack in the mountains. That is really no longer the case. And what the environmental movement looks like from neighborhood to neighborhood, block to block, state to state is different. When we look at what's happening in Baltimore and you're talking about pollution, you'll get an answer about the incinerator in Curtis Bay. But for a lot of people that live in the city proper, we also are talking about trash. Mm-hmm. We're talking about abandoned buildings that children have to pass daily mm-hmm. to go to school, and the amount of life energy it takes to walk past literal garbage heaps on your way to get an education that is, shady at best. So when we talk about the environment, we need to talk about all of those things that affect the quality of life of people and how we can make this a more just and equitable movement. A lot of people have been talking about the environmental justice movement. And again, that I feel like oftentimes black and brown environmentalists and environmentalists of color get shoveled into the environmental justice movement because it sounds like civil rights movement. So let's just put all the colored folks in this corner. But ultimately, that can't work. With the electorate diversifying itself so much that in terms of what we're doing, people have to realize that in terms of what the electorate looks like in a good 20 years, most of the folks that are going to vote are going to be black and brown. So you have to address their issues, and you have to put this in idea of environment in terms of where they are. Again, it's about meeting people are. When I go into East Baltimore and the problem is trash, I may not talk about water pollution by itself, but when we know that crumb or that chicken bone or whatever that ends up in the sewer, ends up in the Patapsco River, that ends up going out into the bay, or you want to keep your lawn pretty and the pesticides running off of your lawn go into this river that end up going into the bay. That's how people can connect the issues. So I think it's very important for people within the environmental movement to realize it's not just about backpacking anymore. Like, people are living with environmental pollution all around the state in various ways, and we really need to be able to talk the language of the people.
It's going way beyond the Sierra Club. Sarah?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's a really important new trend that we have, and I'd like to think of not the environmental justice movement as being the outlier, but really the main thing that's happening right now, and mm-hmm. in fact, the entire environmental movement should be the environmental justice movement. I think one of the things that happened in terms of the climate issue is that a lot of people hoped that the big environmental groups plus, national governments from all over the world were going to get together in Copenhagen and come up with a big solution to the climate crisis, and that completely fell apart for a number of reasons that we could talk about. But that's changed the locus to the local communities. Now it's people who are stopping pipelines, and it's the Idle No More movement of indigenous people from Canada and then spread into the United States. And it's people like these ranchers and tribal members in Nebraska who are actually working together to stop this pipeline from going through. So there's many, many different locations where the environmental movement is taking place, and I think understanding how those are becoming powerful and how they work together and how they together can actually take on both the local crises but also the global crises. I think that's one of our big questions for the years ahead.
Let's have a closing thought from one of our listeners at 410-319-8888. Judith McKenzie, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I'm Reverend Judith McKenzie. And I used to work with Jeff Singer with the homeless. I've worked in human services for 31 years. Back in 2009, I was declared permanently disabled. I've seen this thing from the front and the back. I've worked. When you say grassroots, that term is a lot different now. Because I used to tell people, I've worked in every ghetto from Baltimore City, Bonner County, Howard County, Harper County, and everywhere else. But
Reverend, we only have like 2 minutes left, so
right.
I just wanted to...
Okay, but my concern was, I also went to church with Miss Eiffel, but my concern, just real quickly, with the $15 an hour situation, if you can raise the minimum wage and that type of thing, wage, what have you, but one, there's two things that have to happen. One, you can give people more income, money in their pocket, to support other businesses and small businesses and big businesses. But if they don't know how to save, then they will be right back in the same situation they were in before. One of the most frustrating things for me and colleagues working at YWCA Shelter back in the day was that we would see the same people a year later after we would find them housing, this, that thing, what have you. You're talking about getting the one of the young ladies said getting to know the people, meeting where they are. We don't do that anymore. I can't do it anymore. But when I met them where they were, you have to really understand people are not listening to your show. The poor people are not getting into what you're talking about. Why don't we know? Because
so, Reverend Kennedy, I'm sorry, we really are out of time, and I appreciate your closing our show with your final thoughts. The Reverend Judith McKenzie, who's been an activist in our community. I want to thank our guests for today who have joined us here, Sarah Van Gelder from Yes Magazine, the Reverend Meredith Moyes, Jeff Singer, and Sergio Espana from United Workers. Thank you all for being with us here on the show today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mark.
Remind you on your way out of here that on the way out of here, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to Common Core, you can learn about the important issues of affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's MarylandEducators.org. And the Mark Steiner Show is also brought to you in part by MeetQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeetQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeetQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you. For more information, www.mecu.com. And the Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cut. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, and find out about our guests and the work they do, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. You can also listen to and download all of our podcasts on iTunes. Go to steinershow.org to get your tickets and join us at the Annapolis Summit this Wednesday with the governor. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.